Okay, today is the 3rd of October 2019. It is also the 4th of Tishrei.
Yeah.
Right? 4th of Tishrei. Tav Shin Pei. Wow.
Tav Shin.
Torah Shebal Peh. That's what Agudas Yisrael has been putting up. The year of Torah Shebal Peh. So we have the Sima Shas coming up. Okay, so we are up to Musar Day of Parshas Maaseh, Perek Lamed Hei, having to do with the Ari Miklat, the sanctuary cities, as well as the person who kills by accident, who kills people at the shogig, and therefore he's got to run there and he's got to stay there, etc. So just one, just interesting point, and the sort of this conflict that we see behind throughout this perek is the conflict between punishing the person, on the other hand, making sure that he stays safe. So this is brought home in the Sefer Birchas Peretz. Birchas Peretz is put together by Chaim Kanievsky. Peretz, I believe, is his mother. By the Stipler himself. The Peretz was his mother, and Chaim was his father, and hence Chaim Kanievsky is his son. I think that that's who we're talking about here. So in Parshas Maaseh...
I just want to give over something, because everybody always asks me. So I want to spread my knowledge to you, especially to the colony. The Vikings had a little bit of the same system. So when you did something like this, you can buy yourself out from this blood revenge.
Okay.
Twice. The third time, the relative was not able to accept blood money. He has to kill.
So in the Torah explicitly says no blood money.
Would it help? Blood money wouldn't help. He had to kill it the third time.
He has to, okay? Well, all right, well, that's the distinction. In our parak, it talks about not taking kofar nafsho. Hopefully, we'll get to that towards the end.
There is some kind of logic, even this logic, because they wanted to offset.
Well, what's the point of, what good does it do you to just kill someone? Right? Okay. So in Parshas Maaseh, what is it? So he points out that there's an idea of saving the guy, and there's an idea of punishing the guy. That the pasuk seems to talk about that these cities are going to be able to protect the Goel Adam, that it's for the good of the Rotzeach in order to save him. On the other hand, what's the halacha? That it's a chiyuv, that it's an obligation for him to stay there. Now, there is a bit of this question out there, which we, I guess, discussed on Halacha Day last week, of, well, what if he knows he's not going to be killed? Or what if he goes out, the Mishnah itself tells us he doesn't go out to war, that even if he's needed to be a general in war, he doesn't go out. So we discussed on Halacha Day why that would be. But it still is overall question of to what extent is the guy going to be forced to stay there? Now, if you ask people, so is there a concept of jail in Judaism? So the answer is no. The Torah does not talk about jail beyond holding a guy for a night or two until Beis Din can figure out what it's going to do. But it doesn't mean that there's no extra judicial right of jail. Meaning Beis Din does have the power of enforcing law and order, and Beis Din could do as they see fit in order to make sure that law and order is being observed. So sometimes that could take the form of actual punishments to make sure law and order is observed, and sometimes it could take the form of giving makos or something like that, and sometimes it could take the form maybe of this, that we're going to put the person in prison or make sure the person doesn't leave the Ir Miklat under those circumstances. But it just seems from the Torah itself, and learning Maseches Makos, that the guy can leave, he's just at his own risk if he does leave. But anyways, we at least do require that the person show up at the Ir Miklat. That you get the impression from Mishnayis and Makos, that we make sure the guy actually gets there. What?
Did they have holding pens in America?
We don't see it. It doesn't mean that it didn't exist, but we don't see that it existed. So, in the Sefer Birchas Peretz, he points out that, on the other hand, the Torah is very careful about making sure the guy gets there, to the point that we make sure that there's signs up all over the place in order to make sure that he's going to get there, and we make sure that he's going to be safe while in the Ir Miklat, and we make sure that he's taken care of while he's in there. So, on the other hand, he's obligated to be there. So you could sort of like lighten the load in both directions. Just say, okay, we'll let him out, and we'll just make sure the guy doesn't kill him or stay separate. Why what is this insistence? So he adds in at the end that we do have an idea called Yiras HaOnesh, that there is a principle, and it's a good idea, that people should be afraid of the punishment. Right? We see right now this woman, what's her name? The woman who's for the college scandal, who now has to go to prison. She has to go to prison for 14 days. And everybody's going nuts. Oh, how is she going to survive 14 days in prison? As if she's not going to be guarded and taken care of at every moment. What? And she'll be able to lose time. So that's, I think, an example of just Yiras HaOnesh. Just the concept of going to prison is just a very scary thing for a person to go to. And it makes sense. So there is an idea called Yiras HaOnesh. Now he distinguishes and says, Yiras HaOnesh is not the same thing as Yiras HaChet or Yiras Shemayim. Yiras HaChet or Yiras Shemayim is a idea having to... That's a Ruchnius idea. That's an idea of... you know, we are concerned. We don't want to disappoint the Kaddish Baruch Hu. We have an awesome respect for Kaddish Baruch Hu. All that has to do with God. Yiras HaOnesh is that that's not has to do with God. That has to do with me. But yet, it is an important principle. We do instill that principle. That's good. I mean, we as a way of encouraging and enforcing good behavior. So sometimes there is an onesh that is set up, not necessarily on a ruchnius level, but just simply on a gashmius level. And that's perhaps is the goal of many of these of the punishments that the Torah sets up. As Rav Moshe writes in the only tshuva in all of Igros Moshe that was written to a Gentile. Have you mentioned this before?
No, but that's evident.
It's evident, but okay.
It's evident because the reason to have reasons. There are a couple of reasons, but one reason is to, as you said, deter someone to do the crime.
Right.
So Goyim, they will say, is it worth it to do this if I go to prison? They make like a financial, economic.
Oh, they make a calculation.
But the reason for us not to do the same thing is that it's forbidden in the Torah. We don't care. We don't need a prison because the reason we don't do it because we feel it's wrong.
Okay. That's if we're all a bunch of tzaddikim, but we're not necessarily all a bunch of tzaddikim. That's Rav Kanievsky's point in the Berachot Haaretz. Okay, fine.
And that's why the Torah doesn't want us to have prisons because it's not something a yid would do.
But we have put people in prison.
Right. Except, well, that's only for a night or two in order to hold somebody in place. It's not as a punishment in its own right. But I just there is a tshuva that I didn't bring the exact I didn't look up the exact spot, but there is a tshuva that Rav Moshe writes to Governor Carey in New York. I believe it is the only tshuva in Igros Moshe that is written to a non-Jew. What is it about? It's about the death penalty. That at some point Governor Carey wanted to get was visiting the issue of the death penalty in New York State, and he wanted positions from various faith groups. So it's well known that Governor Carey was very close with Rav Moshe Scherer, who was the head of Agudas Yisrael. So Moshe Scherer asked Rav Moshe to write a tshuva on the topic, which he did. I don't know if there's an English version that exists anywhere. I mean, there probably is someplace, but I don't know if that's in print. But there is a Hebrew version in Igros Moshe, where Rav Moshe spends the first paragraph talking about how wonderful it is to live in a democracy, and we really appreciate it. And Rav Moshe knows what he's talking about, as he had his first rabbinate in a place that was very much not a democracy, under very difficult extreme difficulty in Russia. And then he goes on and says that, on one hand, we do have a death penalty. On the other hand, it was never enforced. So how do you work with that? It was enforced once every 70 years, or maybe not even that often. How do you cheshbon those two sides out? So he explains that the idea of a death penalty in Jewish law is not about not about the cheshbon. It's not about, I'm going to do this, I don't want to die, so therefore I'm not going to do this. But rather, it's to demonstrate the chamiras hachet, how bad the sin is. Right? It just imparts into us how terrible a particular act is, and therefore it keeps us from doing it. So therefore, yes, it's true that technically we do have a concept of a death penalty in Jewish law, but on the other hand, the death penalty is not about a punishment, but rather enforcing the chumer ha'isser. I think that's the term he uses, how bad the isser is, and therefore woe unto a generation where you actually do end up having to put somebody to death. Okay, so all right. Next issue. So along those lines of recognizing how difficult the Isser is, etc. So there is one of the famous things over the course of this parak is that when a Kohen Gadol is that a person is sent to the Ur Miklat, how long? Until the Kohen Gadol dies. And everybody wonders, well, what is the Kohen Gadol? What does he have to do? What did I do that I'm bound into this? So Rashi gives two approaches. One approach is that because this person has brought Kedusha out of the world, and the Kohen Gadol is one who brings Kedusha in the world, and therefore the two can't coexist. It's just, this is not the famous answer, but it's just that the person can't come into society until and coexist with the Kohen Gadol. As he is. That's the first answer that therefore the Kohen Gadol has to pass away, and then he's allowed to. Then he's allowed out. That's assuming that everything is fine. However, the Gemara seems to direct everyone in the other direction. They know the Kohen Gadol is somehow responsible for this. Now, it's a little odd. So why are we waiting for him to die? The way the Gemara spells it out is because now these people are going to be sitting in jail, davening for the Kohen Gadol to die, and that's why it gets the Kohen Gadol upset. Right? What did I do that all these people are now praying that I get impeached? That I be killed. So that
people go to the city of refuge to get away from being killed by people. So if they left.
Obviously they're not, the Goel Dam can't take them out. If they're allowed to leave, that means that the Kohen Gadol, that means that the Goel Dam is not allowed to kill them anymore. That's what it means.
Really?
Yeah. No, that's the assumption is that the Goel Dam can kill the guy so long as the Kohen Gadol is alive. Once the Kohen Gadol dies, so then the guy's out of the Ur Miklat, and there's no license to kill him anymore. So that's answer number one. The answer number two is that the Kohen Gadol somehow permitted this to happen. That the job of the Kohen Gadol is to enforce peace throughout the land. And if there was a murder that took place under the Kohen Gadol's watch, so he bears some amount of responsibility. Now, what makes things a little bit more complicated is, though, that the Kohen Gadol could even be held responsible for a murder that took place under the previous regime. That the Gemara tells us that if the guy hasn't gone to trial yet and the Kohen Gadol dies, and then another Kohen Gadol gets put in place, and then there's a Gemar Din that the guy's got to go to the Ur Miklat. So it's the second, that guy loses out, but it's now the second Kohen Gadol, the young Kohen Gadol who's just getting started, he's got to wait for him to die. But if you're going to assume that the murder happened because of some problem of the Kohen Gadol, so then it's not his fault, it's the previous guy's fault. So why is he stuck with these tefillahs being offered for him to die? So the Gemara itself raises that question, and the Gemara responds by saying, So the Gemara responds by saying that, well, he should have requested mercy that the Gemar Din not take place against this guy. That the Kohen Gadol could have davened, there's this court case going on, the Kohen Gadol could have davened that the court case be resolved in this guy's favor. That's what the Gemara concludes. Yeah, now that's a little bit of a problem. Wait a second. What does that mean? The court is calling balls and strikes, right? The court is supposed to be judging as they see it, as the facts present themselves. So what does it mean that the Kohen Gadol should daven that the court somehow lets the guy free? How does that work out? So there is Rav Radinsky here digs up something from the Kutzker Rebbe where he says, where he suggests that the tefillah of the Kohen Gadol is that the court should entirely find the guy guilty of murder. What happens then? Yeah, if they find him entirely guilty of murder, so he's left off the hook.
Yes.
Then he goes out. So if the facts indicate that the guy is not really chayev, so the facts indicate that the guy is not really chayev, in which case he's going to go free. And the facts indicate that he is chayev, so let all the judges see that, in which case the guy can't be held guilty if all of the judges are finding him to be guilty. So that's a pretty massive chiddush of the Kutzker Rebbe, and it's also making a bunch of assumptions in the halachos of how Sanhedrins work. First of all, the primary one being that this, the 23 rule, the rule that if all of them vote in one favor, the guy is going to be let off. So most people assume that that only has to do with a capital case. That's only if they decide that he's going to be liable to the death penalty, and all 23 decide that way. So then they would put him then they wouldn't put him to death. But in other cases, they still would put him to death. Another possible. Then they would give him that whatever that punishment is. Also, he suggests. Uh, Right. He also suggests that that rule might only be if they come up with the case right at that point. I mean, they finish they make their closing arguments, and right away all of them say guilty. He says, then we wouldn't put him to death. But if they rest overnight and they sleep on it and they still come back and say everybody holds that he's guilty, so then they wouldn't. And he quotes a couple of other kashas on that here in the Sefer Mishkan Betzalel to say that would be quite a chiddush to say that the Kohen Gadol should be davening for all 23 to find him guilty, that would actually work on a halachic level. So rather, what he suggests is that this goes to a very famous Gemara in Maseches Brachos. Not so much for being a Gemara in Maseches Brachos, but just being a famous story. Oh, yeah. The Gemara tells that Rabbi Meir was being bothered by these biryonim. Who are the biryonim?
Yeah,
so biryonim are generally known as being zealots. It could be in that context they were just troublemakers of some sort. Maybe that's not, it could be borim, like just people that were bad people. But they were driving Rabbi Meir crazy to the point that Rabbi Meir was davening to Hashem. And they should all die. So his wife Beria comes along and says, why are you doing that? He says, well, the Pasuk says, Yitamu Chatayim, that the Chatayim, those people that sin, should die. So he says, she says, Miksiv Chotim Chatayim Ksiv. It doesn't say that the sinner should die, rather it just says that the sin should die. And see there at the end of the sugi where it says that he Vay Rachmi Alayhu will Hadru B'tshuva. So he could request Rachmim for them such that they will come back to do tshuva. Right, so that's what the Gemara responds. Now, it's interesting that some point out but we don't paskin that. We actually paskin to read it as chotim, that the sinners should die. That's how we actually paskin on that pasuk. I had to read the pasuk. But anyways, that's what Beria said to Rabbi Meir. Right, you shouldn't hate the sin, you shouldn't hate the sinner. Therefore, you should hate that the sin should die. You don't have to daven that the sinner should die. So, but some raise the question, why should Rabbi Meir's tefilos help to get these sinners to do tshuva? I mean, if we assume Hakol b'dei shemayim chutz miyir shemayim, so Rabbi Meir is davening to Hashem such that these people should be healed, these people should want to do tshuva. Right? Right. How does that work? How could Hashem impact whether these people would want to do, whether these people would want to do tshuva or not? So he suggests that, quotes that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a famous piece. I think we actually talked about this when we learned Parshas Noach or other. It's definitely come up before. Yaakov Kamenetsky asks, why is it that Noach was unsuccessful in his attempts to get his groups to do tshuva, as opposed to Yaakov that somehow was successful? That Yaakov saw this bad behavior at the well, and Yaakov was able to influence them to do okay, as opposed to Noach. Noach was not able to influence the rest of his generation to do tshuva.
Noach didn't even try.
So there is a medrash that describes him trying. He describes the difference is that Noach got up and said, "You bunch of idiots! Yeah, right? What are you guys thinking? You realize that the flood's going to come down if you don't get your behavior better."
Trying.
So what? So he tried. You can't say he didn't try. He just he was just ineffective. Why was he ineffective? Because he didn't get these people on his team. As opposed to when it comes to, as opposed to Yaakov, the first thing Yaakov said to these shepherds was, "Achi, my brothers." So he got Yaakov on his side. Yaakov got them on his side, and therefore he was able to redirect them in a appropriate way. So if we think about then, right, what's the point of Rabbi Meir's tefillah? So perhaps Rabbi Meir's tefillah is not necessarily that he's davening that Hashem redirect these people, but it's that these people should realize that Rabbi Meir cares about them. That it was a way of Rabbi Meir, right? Rabbi Meir is saying, "I'm davening that you guys do tshuva." Right, so that's a real impactful statement. That means that Rabbi Meir cares about us, and if Rabbi Meir cares about us, then that might influence them in order to be able to do tshuva. So it could be the same thing by the Kohen Gadol, that the Kohen Gadol is not necessarily being held responsible, but the fact that the Kohen Gadol should care about these people, so that then is it would influence, and perhaps he's just even with regards to that story with the Beis Din, that his influence should be felt then with the Beis Din as well. With regards to the Beis Din, he suggests right, that they'll be able to put on their zchus seeing glasses. Actually, he suggested even Hashem might make them have a mistake, and then they'll be able to be allowed to go free. But that's the story that the Kohen Gadol is supposed to be demonstrating. The Kohen Gadol is not necessarily davening that that nothing happened, that there not be any accidental murders, or that this guy be held free. But the Kohen Gadol just demonstrates care about these people. Kohen Gadol demonstrates care about these people. Hey, perhaps the murders might be the accidental deaths or the avoidable deaths or the unintended deaths, they not only will those be able to be avoided, but perhaps even in the court of law, he might be able to be successful in being able to avert some of those punishments. There's actually, I came across, just as I looked at the Gemara in Brachos, and it somehow I got directed to, actually it was in the Masifta Gemara, directed to a line that the Chazon Ish has at the very end of Orach Chaim, so the very last page of Orach Chaim. It just adds in, by the way, Hatikti Migil Yonos HaChumash VaGemara. Let me just put in a couple of notes that we found in, like, it sounds like in Chazon Ish's Chumash. We happen to find this written down in his margins. This was a note that he made on Chumash. So he quotes in Devarim Parakei Chavav that Hashem leaves choice biyara Adam. But just because Hashem leaves the choice by a person is able to influence the avodah of somebody else by tefillah. How does that work? Because v'chol Yisrael ki'ish echad, because everybody is really connected with one another, right, whether people are at tzaddikim, etc. V'al makom baruch hu eino nosim b'livam es akiruv de'im kein lo yizyachis adavu l'boro'av amam im yesh mispal l'fanav al akiruv v'tfilasov nishmas misyachis akiruv she'osa kadosh baruch hu l'boro'av. So Hashem will be closer. I mean, Hashem is not necessarily davening that these people make the right decisions. A person is davening that Hashem appear close to all of these people. And if Hashem appears closer to all of these people, if they feel Hashem's presence, so then they will be less likely to sin. You're not, right, again, you're not davening that they make a different decision. You're davening that Hashem make himself relevant to these people so that, of course, that will be obvious to them to make a different decision. Right? That is a suggestion that the Chazon Ish here has at the very end of Orach Chaim. And then one more note, we've talked about this in the past, but I've always been wondering what others said at this time. The issue, the reparations issue, in the 50s, when a couple of years after the state had now been established, right, Israel has no money, so Ben-Gurion announces that he's already been in contact with the Germans to accept reparations on behalf of Jews that were killed and property that was destroyed during the Holocaust. So that was extremely controversial. First of all, what gives Ben-Gurion the right to negotiate on behalf of these people? But just beyond that, is that really appropriate? So the Rav commented, used the pasuk in this week's parsha, it seems like, to go after Ben-Gurion. He was not a fan of this. The pasuk says, you can't take atonement for the life of a murderer who is ready to die, right? Rather, he must be killed. So Rav Salvechik, in very graphic language, talks about how Ben-Gurion is a Baal Gaiva, and all the people in Mapai, they've been blinded by their own theories that they know everything, that they know the future, and everything is great. And he says, I don't believe that they're actually doing religious persecution, and I'm not afraid of that. I'm afraid of false hashkafa sayadus, that they're imposing a false philosophy upon the Jewish people, and that is this idea of German reparations. He says he thinks that the Germans qualify, he quotes his father, the idea from his father, that any nation that writes on its flag, lo yisachar shem Yisrael od, that has their goal of destroying the Jewish people, so they would qualify as a malik, and therefore we can't take any money from them. Right, a Jewish hand, even the Rosh HaMemshalah's hand, should have been scathed by the bloody coins. I would agree to send diplomats to Germany, have an embassy in Germany. They could even have an embassy in Israel, but no kofar nefesh. We can never take this money back. Or take money they consider, and because that's what they're saying. They're saying that we now have atoned. we now have atoned. They consider the reparations kofer for the 6 million Jews. Right. And even though he might get up and say, and everybody's saying the Jews take money, you know, you could deal with the Jews just by giving them more money. And right. Even if Charette, who is the actual prime minister at the time, is saying that he's not forgiving the Germans, he said they don't hear him. That's not what they're saying. And he's saying, but therefore we've lost our entire moral standing by taking this kofer. Taking this kofar. So it is interesting. That whole episode is a fascinating period of Israeli history, early Israeli history, because Israel now is a couple years in. They are an established country and they're trying to find their footing. And there was a big, just in the general society, it was a big challenge. And I've always wondered what the religious perspective was. What are the Gedolim saying at the time? Yeah. So here is the Rav coming out very much against it. In fact, he adds in here, and there's a little note, the Rav said this paragraph very loudly and forcefully. He says, and who took the responsibility to make such a historical decision and cast upon the Jewish nation a pact with Nazis, if not Ben-Gurion and his friends? They just recently organized in America a Jewish conference attended by assimilated Jews, people who have nothing to do with Judaism. Yidden that were silent and afraid to go to Roosevelt in Washington while the Nazis dragged Yidden from Warsaw and from Brisk, from Vilna and from Slum to Majdanek and Auschwitz. They were silent while Jews were being shot in Ponor and Vilna, and now these Jews decided that we can make a pact with them. These Jews came and they paskened and decided that we can sign a pact with the Nazis. Ben-Gurion directed the whole thing from Israel. It was televised, the whole Knesset, including the Mizrahi and the whole Orthodoxy, and everyone was silent. And he has one more paragraph where he goes after Ben-Gurion, that Ben-Gurion doesn't really... that is doing this because he became haughty, became a Baal Gaiva, and that's what has blinded him. But of course, a Baal Gaiva can never be a Navi. And therefore, the Rav goes against it. This is not obviously not a simple issue. My favorite comment on it, we've quoted before, is when in Parshas Bo, in the Sefer, Rav Sarutskin, I forget the name of the Sefer, but Rav Sarutskin's commentary on the Torah. So he makes allusion to this, where Hashem asks Moshe to please go to the Egyptians and get money from them. So why does Hashem say please if it's a command? So the response, so his explanation is that you can't force a person to go and take money from a person that he had been suffering from. So Hashem is the answer is not available. Right? Whether it's pro or con, it's hard. You can't tell. Should you take money from them, or should you just let them be and not take anything from them? And perhaps the answer to that is subjective, which is why Hashem said to Moshe, I'm not giving it to you as a mitzvah, I'm giving it to you as an option. Right? Please feel free to go to the Egyptians and try to take money, and people could do as they deem fit. That also is sourced in this parent in Bamidbar. All right, we'll stop here.
Was it because the Egyptians...